Hi, I'm Jules Van Binsberg, and a finance professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania.
And I'm Jonathan Burke, a finance professor at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University.
And this is the All Else Equal podcast.
Welcome back, everybody. Today, we're going to be talking about what's called Occam's Razor. And particularly, we want to think about Occam's Razor in the context of business decisions. So, from a business perspective, when is it worth to explore an implausible theory? And when is it worth doubting a commonly believed theory? From a business perspective, if you turn out to be right, the payoff can be huge.
Yeah, it's a huge comparative advantage to know something that other people don't know. So this is a very interesting question. Now, of course, most commonly believed theories turn out to be true, and most implausible theories turn out to be false. So by definition, an implausible theory has a low probability of being true, and so it's costly to investigate lots of implausible theories. The question is, when should we investigate?
Yeah, while I generally agree with you, Jonathan, I also must say that if we just look back in history and you think about what most people at some point have believed to be true and what at the time were commonly believed things, I think there are a lot of things that have turned out to completely not be true. If we would go and have a conversation with somebody who lived 300 years ago, I think we would not even believe the things that they will assume to be generally true.
Yeah, I agree, Jules. I mean, it's a sad fact that actually how much of what we all commonly believe to be true might eventually turn out to be false. The best example of that is Newton's laws. With that said, I think the only defense against this is the scientific method. The only way to figure out what's true and what's not is the scientific method.
And so what was the scientific method? We spent some time on it in one of our first episodes. It's essentially evidence-based decision-making. And I think that a crucial part of evidence-based decision-making, and that's also the hardest part of it, I think, is that you need to actively be interested in looking to reject your own beliefs. You must be open and willing to find evidence that makes you change your mind. And given the fact that most people are particularly averse to changing their mind, that is the hardest piece.
Yeah, so I think at the core of the scientific method is a theory can only be rejected, and that you have to set up the game so that you can actually reject the theory and not pretend not to reject it because you just haven't looked hard enough.
What I like about what you just said is that this is what sometimes people also call the adversarial system, right? Where you intentionally set up things in an adversarial way. And I do think that recently we're losing some of that in terms of when everybody always wants to be pleasant to each other and nice to each other, it's difficult to set up an adversarial system because the friction itself of the debate and the disagreement is actually leading to a lot of insight. And I think we should not forget that. So I think that there are a bunch of different criteria that we can think about, but one of them, and that's also the title of today's episode, is Occam's Razor. Let's first describe how most people would describe it, and then let's give our interpretation to it. I think how most people would describe it is that the easiest theory is most likely to be the right one.
Or the simplest theory is the most likely to be the right one. And I think that explanation of Occam's Razor is, I think, actually, it's just wrong in the sense that there's no reason why the world should be simple. Quantum mechanics is not a simple theory. It's probably the most successful theory ever developed by humankind. So it's not that the theory is simple, it's how the theory came about. So one way a theory can become complicated is you kludge the theory. I don't know how many of our listeners know what the word kludge is, but in programming, if there's a bug and you're too lazy to find out why there's a bug, all you do is you write an if statement that says, if this happens, fix it, and you leave the bug. That's called a kludge. And so a kludge theory is a theory which doesn't work, and every time you find that it doesn't work, you adjust the theory just for that one case to make it work in that case. And then another case comes up, and you do another kludge. And by the end, there are many, many kludges. And therefore, that results in a complicated theory. And at some point, you turn around and say, wait a minute. The fact that there are all these kludges suggests that the theory itself is wrong. And of course, The perfect example of this is the Ptolemaic theory of the planets.
Yeah, so every time you observe a planetary movement that you don't understand, you add an extra epicycle to the system that just explains that one particular thing you couldn't explain before. And in the end, you have so many epicycles that you kludge the whole system so many times that it looks like it's working quite reasonably well. But, how do we get to that theory? Well, in such a complicated way that, of course, in the end, it turns out to be completely incorrect.
And when Copernicus stepped up and said, okay, the real theory is the Earth goes around the sun, that was a very simple theory compared to the Ptolemaic theory that had many, many epicycles. The irony, of course, was the Ptolemaic theory worked better. At the time Copernicus proposed the correct theory that the Earth went round the sun, the Ptolemaic theory worked better. Why? Because all the kludges had made it work very well. But the point of Occam's razor is that complication means the theory is likely to be wrong. Copernicus could get almost as good as the theory that had zillions of kludges with one simplifying assumption that the Earth goes around the sun. Oh, by the way, the reason Copernicus's theory didn't do as well as the Ptolemaic theory is Copernicus made a mistake. He assumed that planets' orbits were circles. In fact, they're ellipses. And once you put that in, of course, then the Copernicus theory blows the Ptolemaic theory out of the water. And in particular, when you discover a new planet, the Ptolemaic theory, of course, is hopeless at describing the motion of that planet, and the Copernicus system explains it very, very well.
Now, there's another thing, Jonathan, that I think we should consider that Occam's razor doesn't necessarily say anything about, but that should be included in when we evaluate implausible theories. And let's bring in some economics into the equation. So what are the incentives of the people proposing the theories? So let's think about Galileo Galilei, who I really like to include in this example, because what were his economic incentives to go against the prevailing idea that the Earth was the center of the universe and didn't move? Right? He had nothing to gain from it other than he just really believed that this was true. If somebody proposes a theory and it's absolutely obvious that it's in their self-interest for that theory to be true, and it's even worse, it's not even that they're interested in believing the theory is true, it's in their interest that other people believe that their theory is true so that they can make money off of that. But in the case of Galileo Galilei, I think he had absolutely no incentives to say it. It only cost him, both personally and maybe even financially as well.
Yeah, it's a nice example, because at the time, Galilei's theory that the Earth was not the center of the universe was a very implausible theory. Nobody would even dream the Earth was not the center of the universe. But take another example. Let's talk about cold fusion. I don't know how many of our listeners remember this, but there was a time when a group of scientists at the University of Utah claimed that they could do the fusion of hydrogen to get helium in conditions that were nowhere near the conditions that people up till that point knew were necessary, like the middle of a hydrogen bar. And so, of course, that theory turned out to be fraud. And again, we think about the incentives. The scientists proposing that theory at the University of Utah stood to make an enormous amount of money if the theory's true. And so they weren't very careful with the evidence.
No, and with these big breakthroughs, there are generally two parties involved, right? There's a group of revolutionaries or a group of people that think they have the new thing, and they have an incentive to believe that it's true because they tend to gain from it. But there's often also, particularly in a business situation, a group of incumbents, a group of people that are currently selling a product whose product would really be threatened by the discovery of this new invention. And it's in their interest for the theory not to be true. And so when we get scientific, between quotation marks, papers that are essentially motivated or financed or written by these two groups, the question is, what should we do with that evidence? And how do we take into account the incentives of the particular groups involved?
And I think that brings up a third criteria for deciding whether or not we want to investigate an implausible theory, which is how much money is at stake were the theory to be true? So in other words, if somebody's claiming, look, this theory is true, and you realize that there are people that, if it were true, would be making a lot of money, then you have to be very suspicious, because those people have a huge incentive to investigate the theory. So if they haven't come out and said the theory is true, it likely isn't true. They likely did investigate it and found out that it was implausible, and therefore you shouldn't bother investigating yourself.
So again, from an economics point of view, Jonathan, I think we have a tough trade-off here, honestly. Because on the one hand, you want scientists to have an incentive to work really hard and discover something new. But on the other hand, you want scientists to be as independent as they can and really be interested in just finding out the truth and not having the economic incentive. And so what is the optimal mix of these two things? I'm not sure that's so obvious.
Well, you know, there's another implausible implication, which is that the theory, you come up with a theory that explains one thing, but it also has other implications, which you ignore. Take the theory that UFOs exist, that people are visiting the Earth. Well, there's an implausible implication of that, is that we know how much energy it would take for any foreign person to come and visit the Earth. So it would seem implausible that we'd visit and then leave without doing anything else, given how much energy. So there's an implausible implication is, why did they not stay? So again, you could think about other implications of the theory and realize that those other implications we don't see. And so that probably means the theory isn't right.
Now, bringing it back to business decisions, I think one important way to frame it as well is that we have what in statistics we call a trade-off between a type one and a type two error. And I think we already went into this quite a bit when you did freedom of expression. So here is the best way to explain it. You can make one of two errors. You can erroneously reject a new implausible theory that ends up being true. This is what in statistics we call a type one error. And there's a type two error, which is that you fail to reject a theory that is actually false. And so we need to trade off these two things against each other.
Let me just quickly sum up where we are. I think what we are saying is, if you're in a business and there's an implausible theory that you wonder might be true, and if it is true, you could make a lot of money. What are some of the things you should look for in deciding whether to spend the resources investigating? And what we identified is one is Occam's razor. It is how complicated is the theory and why did it become complicated? Two, the incentives of the people that proposed the theory. How much money do they have to make? And what's the likelihood they're proposing a theory for their own economic gain? How much money is at stake if the theory were to be true? In other words, that tells you how likely other people have already investigated it, right? And finally, are there other implications of the theory that seem implausible and we could rule the theory out? So we think those are pretty good criteria for thinking about whether or not you should be investigating a theory.
Now would be a good time to introduce our guest. And our guest is somebody who's really walked the walk in the sense that he really went through an example of having to evaluate a very implausible theory for which payoffs were really large. It is, in fact, the example of the company called Theranos. Theranos was a company that claimed that with a single drop of blood, dozens of different blood tests could be done all at the same time. And if it had been true, it would, in fact, have revolutionized medicine, and it would have really changed the way that we do blood tests everywhere in the world, which is potentially one of the reasons why the company was valued at the multi-billion dollars that it was valued at the time it was exposed. And of course, by now, we've all understood that this implausible theory was in fact not true. And so our guest is John Ioannidis, who is a professor of medicine at Stanford and also of epidemiology and population health. Thank you so much for being with us today, John.
Thank you for inviting me, Jonathan. This is really a great opportunity to discuss with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you, John. We're very happy that you're with us.
So, John, you were one of the first people that figured out that Theranos was a fraud. Tell us, what made you suspicious and what motivated you to spend your time investigating Theranos?
So Theranos had its headquarters in my neighborhood, and I was walking by their headquarters. So I Googled them up, and I realized that they were offering to test 100 times more people in 100 times less time with 100 times less cost, and use some fancy technology that would completely change healthcare. So it seemed like a great promise. Initially, I said, that's wonderful. I can run all the tests that we run in my team at 100 times less cost. Let's see how they do it. I realized that they have published nothing about how they do it. They had no publications in the peer-reviewed literature. Basically, they had no evidence. So they started seeming to me that they failed some very basic premises of the scientific method, where you need to be able to see the evidence, share the evidence, scrutinize the evidence with organized skepticism, and it seemed that none of that was there.
I think that in some sense, we face a trade-off, right, between type 1 and type 2 errors, in the sense that big breakthroughs are always going to be incredibly unlikely to be true. And so now the question is, and I think that it's also a big question for universities today, how likely is it that people that have a big breakthrough are initially being portrayed as crackpots or something that can never be true because the scientific consensus just isn't there? Because by definition, a big breakthrough means that you're thinking outside of the box of where everybody else is thinking. So how should we deal with this trade-off and with this trade between type 1 and type 2 errors? Which big breakthroughs are worth pursuing, if you will, and which ones will end up not being breakthroughs at all?
I think that it's very likely that when you have a claim for a major breakthrough, most of those will prove out to be wrong. Just with statistical considerations, you have what we call the winner's curse. The first findings tend to be exaggerated. Even if you do everything perfectly fine, you're just a lucky guy, or actually the not lucky guy, to chance about a red herring. And I think that this is very common. There's nothing wrong about it. It's not necessarily fraud or conflicts or that someone is doing on purpose. Although we have lots of conflicts and the biases that are superimposed on our searching process in science. Now, beyond that, there are discoveries. Science does make progress. Clearly, we have made tremendous progress over the years, and we've had many millions of scientists who have worked to generate these incremental steps towards progress. So we need to test and retest, replicate, reproduce what has been proposed, and try to isolate which out of these multiple claims eventually tend to have more weight by being able to be demonstrated again and again. This is easier to do when there is a replication culture, when there is transparency, when people can see how things are done, they can understand how the methods have operated. Unfortunately, in much of the scientific literature, there's no transparency. Much like the Theranos example, the methods are very opaque. It's impossible to get them to work. You're just reading a scientific paper, and it looks like an advertisement that we need to trust that, wow, you did that work. But how exactly did you do it? I cannot do it in my laptop, in my hands, in my team.
So, John, from a business perspective, obviously, it is the unlikely theories that turn out to be true where you make the most amount of money because you have this great competitive advantage. So what do you think? So how do you decide when an unlikely theory is worth taking seriously?
I think unlikely theories need to be given a chance and to be tested. But obviously, it's a gamble if you want to invest on them very early on when they're still very unlikely. So in the long run, if you invest on a very large number of unlikely theories, you're likely to do okay because you'll get one or two of them to survive. But I think that it's better if one can use some judgment plus evidence to guide that selection. So I think that unlikely findings that come from small studies, from conflicted studies, from opaque studies, from studies that don't use the best methods, that have biases in the design or the execution, or very suboptimal reporting and documentation, are less likely to do well.
The discovery of the scientific method, as I think is probably one of the greatest breakthroughs in human history, the fact that we started applying this, particularly from, say, an economic historical point of view, we really started seeing large increases in economic growth once the scientific methods started to be taken seriously in terms of what ideas would be implemented and which ones wouldn't. But we, and correct us if you think differently, but it seems that we're starting to see a bit of an erosion of how much people are willing to adhere to that method. And there are all kinds of different approaches that I think 20 years ago would not be considered, but today are getting a lot of attention. So why do you think so many people today are unwilling to use the method and take it seriously and use the scrutiny that it implies for lots of ideas?
So science is a wonderful, both methodological and social construct. And I think that based on its successes, it has won a place within our society that has become more and more powerful. Unfortunately, at the same time, it has been widely misused. And there's many ways to misuse science. Lots of people want to use science to their benefit, not to the benefit of society, not to the benefit of curiosity and knowledge and just clean knowledge that helps humanity, but just trying to make the best for them and for their team and for their people, whoever these people are or whoever are to gain from that. This means that there's also some frustration from those who see that science is becoming oppressive to their own interests and maybe is trying to overregulate what they do. So we have those who see science as a weapon and those who suffer from science becoming a weapon because that weapon is sometimes turned against them. It's a situation where science is no longer judged on scientific terms. It's not just appraised as a scientific method type of question. It becomes something where many other motives distort our communication and our ability to understand and use science. And then you have lots of people who are dissatisfied. They just don't trust that. They see that it's their enemy. It's turned against them. It's diminishing their prospects. It's not what is moving society forward. It is what is holding them back.
So, John, you think this is the reason people today, there seems to be this belief that somehow we have to be suspicious of scientists. An example of that is the Great Barrington Declaration during COVID, where a bunch of scientists got together expressing their opinion. I mean, there were obviously, there may be other scientists who had a different opinion, but there was a tendency to interpret what they were doing as somehow nefarious versus they were just trying to get what they considered to be the evidence out.
Declarations and memoranda and open letters and petitions and groupings of science is an interesting phenomenon. I think that it has become more common nowadays because there's so much at stake with science that for scientists, it's very difficult now to fight alone. You can publish as many papers as you wish in the best journals, but if you're facing politicians and media and social media and influencers and companies and big tech, if you're just a scientist or a group of scientists, you feel like a very minuscule quantity against these major powers. So this means that many scientists are trying to coalesce. You mentioned the Great Barrington Declaration is one such coalescence of scientists who tried to oppose some possibly dominant, I'm not sure that it was dominant perception about how to deal with the pandemic. And the clash then enters the domain of who can recruit more journalists, who can recruit more social media, who can recruit more influencers, who can have campaigns, subverting campaigns to eliminate the opponents and downgrade what they say and who they are, even worse, and just as we have seen, destroy them in a sense. So that's no longer science. It's some sort of warfare. It's warfare that probably is more political and partisan rather than scientific discussion, scientific debate, and exchange of evidence. And I think that people who are very powerful and can mobilize the right connections are likely to gain the upper hand, even if their science is wrong. And I think that we run the risk of eventually getting science dominated by who can mobilize the most powerful non-scientific forces in the game.
What's so interesting about that, John, is that we have a set of rules in which a battle and an engagement within the scientific community is allowed to be fought. And so one possible response to the Great Barrington Declaration would have been to organize a very public, clear debate with a panel of scientists on both sides, where in fact the scientific arguments were going to be discussed. But that clearly wasn't chosen to be done. Instead, it was based on all these other sort of warfare methods. But don't you think that in some sense, it's a sign of weakness when one of the parties starts to refer to those type of warfare methods as opposed to sticking with the rules that we had agreed on?
It is a sign of weakness. And it is a sign of weakness for all of us, I think, if we resort to this type of resolution of our debates and conflicts so that, you know, the debates then do not happen. The right data are not collected. The right data are not compared. And what we see is just that subversive type of elimination and destruction of the opponents, both as personalities, as people, as intentions, as conflicts or alleged conflicts. We saw that very prominently during the pandemic. In my perspective, I had published even before the pandemic that I'm not going to sign any petitions about science, and I kept my promise because I believe that in science, it could be that one scientist may be correct and 1 million scientists may be wrong. So I think that it does not prove anything to say that one petition gathers 1 million signatures while another gathers 500,000 signatures. I think what matters is to be open, to be ready to admit that, goodness, I may be in error. Let me try to hear what other people have to say. Let me try to learn from them. Maybe they have something interesting that I haven't thought about. Have I thought about what they really want to say? Do I understand what they really want to say? Can I put it in the strongest possible frame before I start saying that they're wrong. Unless we have that, I think that we're not going anywhere. We're just becoming more like followers of sects or of teams or political parties rather than scientists.
Or religious communities or semi-religious communities, yes.
Even worse than sects probably, because science is more powerful than religious communities. You know, religious communities cannot really kill you if they get things wrong, unless they tell you to commit suicide, which is pretty rare. But science, if it gets things wrong, can really kill you.
Is there an easy solution to this? How do we solve this problem?
We need to start with the perception and the understanding that we don't know everything. We have major gaps in knowledge, even in established fields, and even more in fields where the evidence is very new and fresh or just being accumulating. For example, the pandemic was one such example where we started with a new virus, a new situation that we had very little information and new, very little evidence that we could cross-link based on what had happened in previous pandemics. So we need more humility, I think, as a starting point. We need more understanding of what other scientists and what other scholars think and perceive and are trying to propose. We need to be able to have more rigorous research agendas. We're doing lots of studies. We're publishing probably something like 7 million papers every year within the scientific community, and very few of them actually are worth the paper that they're printed on or the online site where they appear. So we can do better.
You know, John, one of the things that I've often thought about is I think in the peer review process, we do not explicitly worry about incentives. In economics, incentives plays a very large part. And we somehow think that the people doing the peer review will have the correct incentives, you know, and we just assume it. That by itself is a huge part of the responsibility for why we have so many millions of nonsense papers published.
You're absolutely right. Peer review is probably better than not having it at all. We had the International Congress on Peer Review and Scientific Publication in Chicago a couple of months ago, and I was one of the directors. So we heard lots of nice ideas and some interesting data about how to improve it. But at the end of the day, basically, I think 25% of papers that go through peer review are improved, 5% get worse, and about 70% are not touched. This is the average situation. If you have a conflicted situation or a kind of an ill situation, you can get even worse percentages of performance. And this means that we need to be open to the possibilities of criticism from the very early phases, make sure that we have all voices heard, that we don't silence people, chances to opposite ideas to prove that they're correct or that they're wrong, and then try to select what is the best and always be there to revise what we think is the best. Because science is never fixed. It's never just a dogma that will never change. In some fields, the change rate is far faster than others. For example, in infectious disease and epidemiology, the change rate of quote-unquote truth is very fast because we're talking about very volatile, dynamic situations as opposed to the gravitational constant, which probably is not going to change for a while.
So, John, let me ask you one last question, which I think is a very important question, and there's quite a lot at stake. Where do you think COVID-19 has originated from?
My perception has been from the very beginning that to answer that question, we need to stick to the scientific method and the norms of science, which include sharing, which means that all the data, all the lab books of the Wuhan lab need to be accessible. They need to be disclosed. So I think that at a minimum, we need full transparency. We need full cooperation and people leaving their differences aside. This is a question that has cost many millions of lives from the virus and probably far, far more from the measures that we took and from everything that we did, perhaps with good intentions, but really devastating at the end of the day.
Well, John, thank you so much. There's so many important topics we covered in this short time. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It was really wonderful.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the All Else Equal podcast. Please leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. And be sure to catch our next episode by subscribing or following our show wherever you listen to your podcasts. For more information and episodes, visit allelseequalpodcast.com or follow us on LinkedIn. The All Else Equal podcast is a production of Stanford University's Graduate School of Business and is produced by Alumni FM.